Hi, I'm Natalie, and welcome to Infinitely Irrational, where we discuss the real, eccentric, and complex history of math. In each episode, we unearth the wild stories behind some famous or not so famous mathematicians. Today, we close up our discussion about infinity and Georg Cantor, and this episode will attempt to answer the following questions. Should you count sheep or letters to get to sleep? Can you have infinite infinities? What does this have to do with math? Let's find out. Everyone, welcome back. We have Johanna again to finish up our Cantor trilogy on infinity. We've been talking about infinity upon infinity upon infinity, and we don't have infinite episodes of Cantor, but we've gone through two infinities in two episodes. Maybe we'll be fortunate enough to find another one. So as far as Cantor is concerned, it was speculated that due to the severe criticism that his work received, he battled with depression. And we talked a little about this in one of the episodes where the rebelliousness and the deterministic philosophy and things like that. But for me, what I thought was interesting was, you know, I'm always looking back at the other mathematicians. And I thought it was interesting that like Fermat, who was a counselor, by virtue of him not being a mathematician and being a counselor, he didn't have any friends. So he did his math and he was like, whatever, I don't care. That's why he said things like about Descartes, like groping about in the shadows. And they had this whole fight about tangents and stuff like that. But he didn't care. He was like, I'm going to do me. I'm going to live my best life and, you know, whatever. But Cantor, who here is a mathematician, he did care about it and it upset him greatly. I just realized that I went on this whole spiel and I wanted to actually give you some time to talk. So let me be quiet for a minute. Hi, welcome back. I got so excited about that though.
Yeah, excitement, you know, it's great. And I'm just going with that. Absolutely. So hello again. Really happy to be back. So you're getting me in point where it's difficult because you mentioned Cantor's experience with depression and he spent many years in a sanatorium and actually died of a heart attack in 1918 in Halle. So his life was not easy in the sense that he did value his work and the fact that his work was not recognized, not even not recognized, it was ridiculed, really cost him dearly. But on the other hand, as we said, today is fully recognized and is taught. And it's valued. So he got his recognition in the end, which I suppose it's really important.
How many times have we seen, you know, where it's like the artist, because we're going back to art again, it's not recognized until after they die. And it's like, this again is just like a, could we just listen to people sometimes maybe? There's an episode of, what is it, like Doctor Who? I think it's Doctor Who. Watch it. Somebody is going to get in the comments and tell me I'm wrong, which is fine. But they bring Van Gogh back to the current day and he sees the influence that his work has on the world today. And it's like this really, he like sheds a tear and it's really meaningful. And I've seen the scene 1,000 times. I haven't watched Doctor Who yet. I'm a terrible person for not watching Doctor Who and I want to, but I, you know, you can't do everything in life. But I'm going to watch Doctor Who at some point. But that particular scene, it's like, I think about that, you know, it's like, what would all the people, Pascal, you know, I mean, I think Cardano would not care at all, but like all the people who would see the influence that their work had on the world today, things that they couldn't even imagine. And especially for someone like Cantor, who was so ridiculed. But why though? Why did we need to do that? And certainly there was probably a time and place for why they were feeling the way they felt. But gosh, it's such a shame.
Yeah, it's a fair question to ask. Why? What was the gain out of kind of fighting so hard back at a person who expressed some new ideas? Sometimes it's strange to consider that.
So I'm going to kick us off here. We're going to talk about finite sets. So that means that there's going to be a set that has a limited number of items. So in this case, we're going to talk about a set that contains a cat, a dog, and a hamster. So just three things. That is going to be the set. Now, the subset of this set, we will call pets, is going to be that whole set with the three items. The empty set, which means you don't have any pets. The set that contains each one of them differently. So one set is going to be the cat only. One set is going to be the dog only, one set's going to be the hamster only. And then, of course, we have the ones that have two of them. So we've got the cat and the dog, we've got the hamster and the cat, and we've got the hamster and the dog. So that set that has three elements that we just talked about, it produces a power set with eight elements, or essentially 2 to the power 3 in this case. This is the cardinality, the number of sets in this case. So that is how I'm going to sort of set us up for this.
Wonderful. Thank you. So now we have an understanding of what a power set is. And we're going to try and build a power set for a set of countable infinities, a size of countable infinity. So, for example, the natural numbers, or if we imagine a set of pets that potentially with evolution, we're going to get like infinite different kind of like species or animals that we can have as pets. So the power set will contain all possible subsets of that, including, as you said, the empty set and the set we started itself. And the question we have to ask now is, can we put the elements of the power set into a one-to-one correspondence with the set we started with?
I want to take a moment here to say probably like 8,000 things. The first thing I want to say is that you and I have talked about this, and we've spent a good amount of time thinking about it and talking about it and how we are going to sort of propose this and explain it. And even with all our discussions, there's still some things that we're like, how are we going to quite put this out? So, you know, if some of this is confusing, like with anything else, right, these were ideas that we're grasping with and something that you can go think about and do more research on yourself, listeners, as you think through this. The second thing I will say is that what we talked about before with Hilbert's infinite hotel is that we're going from 2 to 4, you know, we're going from a number to a number, right? But that's a one-to-one correspondence. Now we're going to take that same idea of the one-to-one correspondence, but instead of it being a single number, we're looking at sets, making a set-to-set correspondence.
Thank you. And it's really important to say that these are ideas that took a long time to not only develop, but also be accepted, as we've seen. And they're definitely not straightforward. And they definitely need some kind of like immersing yourself in them and thinking about them a bit, because they have quite a lot of nuanced ideas in them. It's more fun because we do it with nice pets. So we try and visualize them a bit more easily. So if the power set would have the same infinity as the original set, it means that we could get a set from that power set matched up with each one of the elements of the original countably infinite set. What we will show, similar to our previous episode with the proof by contradiction, will show that we cannot do it. There is going to be a subset inside the power set that cannot be matched to an element. Hence, the power set infinity is bigger. And once you've shown that for one power set, then the same thing applies. So you have the infinite infinities. So, and that's the beauty of it. So we're going to show for one power set, and that the infinity is bigger than the set we started with, and then we're done. Then that applies for whichever set and power set you start with. So this is actually our last proof, but it's going to be our hardest one.
Now, listeners, I want to tell you right now, I just saw Ioana get her notebook, so things are getting serious. Settle down, fasten your seatbelt, get your notebook out. We're going to go for it. All right, we've got set pets. I'm ready.
Yes. So instead of writing boring things like A, B, Z, we can draw cats and mini zebras and stuff. So let's start. We have the set pets. It contains infinite pets in it, different animals and birds or whatever you like, that's fine. And we match each one of those to a subset of the set we started with. So we match it up to an element of the power set. So for example, we can match the cat to the subset that contains dog and hamster, or we can match a panda bear with a subset that contains the panda bear and the cat. And we will pick up and describe and define the said wish, which is the trickiest part of the proof. We call it wish because we like the idea. And we're going to describe the said wish that contains all the elements that are matched to a set that does not contain them. So if we match the cat to the said dog hamster, then the cat belongs to wish because the set is matched to does not contain cat. But panda bear was matched to the panda bear and cat subset. So panda bear does not belong to the set wish because it's matched to a set that contains it. And here we go. We have to match something to the set wish. And let's say we match the zebra to that set wish. And we are asking, does zebra belong to wish? And if zebra were to belong to wish, then it couldn't belong to wish. And vice versa, if zebra did not belong to wish, then it has to belong to wish, which is mind-boggling. Please go back and listen to this again. Absolutely. And that's where the contradiction arises. Essentially, we cannot find an element that we can match to the said wish. And that's how we know the power set definitely has more elements than the set we started with.
So I kind of want to summarize, because what you said is, as you said, it's mind-boggling and like we're kind of grasping with these ideas. And I want to go back to the definition of wish itself so that we can kind of understand this contradiction here. Listeners, like, again, I want you to understand, Rihanna and I have been talking about this. You know, she has done so much work on understanding this proof. I have then come in and been like, let's fight it through and let's make sure we understand it. So we're going to try to break this down here. The way that wish is defined is that it's going to contain all the elements of the original set. So if we go back to our example with cat, dog, and hamster, so wish is going to contain all the elements of that set that are matched to some set that doesn't contain them. Well, if you think about what that means, every set is going to contain cat, dog, hamster. So there's no way for that to be possible. Like where we're talking about zebra, if you try to match zebra with a set that doesn't, well, that's not going to happen. Same with cat, same with dog, same with hamster. So Ioana, did I succinctly explain that well?
I'm a bit skeptical about going, because the proof works for infinity. If we try to see how it would work for a finite set like cat, dog, hamster, so if we were to match the cat with, say, cat dog, and then we match dog with cat hamster and so on, and then the hamster with the empty set, for example, so we already don't have one-to-one correspondence because clearly we have more elements in the power set, but that's finite. So could we create a set wish from there? Like we could, I suppose, to just say, well, if that's our kind of matching, wish would contain the pets that are matched to something that doesn't contain them, in which case it would be just dog. But the problem with the infinite is that it's not if we start with an animal and see what we can match it with, is if we kind of go the other way and say we have this set wish that we created with all the elements that are matched to something that does not contain them, but can we find an element to match to wish? And that's where the thing crashes down, because we're trying to find an element to match to a set that if it contains it, it cannot contain it. And if it doesn't contain it, it has to contain it.
Which is the contradiction itself.
Exactly. That's where the contradiction arises. So you have defined wish in that way, and then you have to match wish with something to maintain the one-to-one correspondence. And you're thinking, okay, how do I maintain that? I need to have an element from pets, so a single animal, matched to that said wish. But the minute you try to find that, by the sheer definition of wish, if you say, I'm matching it to a zebra or whatever, it doesn't matter, any animal that you want to match it with, you say, well, if zebra is matched to it, then it means it doesn't contain it. But if it doesn't contain it, then it has to contain it.
Exactly.
And then you go into this endless loop and this mind-boggling thing where you're saying, well, that element essentially cannot exist. We cannot find something to match wish with.
If the answers are yes and no, it cannot be both yes and no. And I appreciate that we had this conversation because I think for me, like in my head, I can understand it. And then trying to get it out of my mouth into a way that would make sense to someone that, like you just said, you watched the video so much times to try to go through and explain it. And reading this and trying to, so, you know, listeners, like, number one, Ioana is amazing. So, like, shout out to her for that first off. But if this is something that interests you, for sure, go and look it up and spend some time thinking about it. Get in the comments. If you want to talk more about it, for sure, feel free to reach out. But definitely, this is something that is fun to think about and talk about.
Definitely. I mean, as you said, it's not an easy thing. I had to go over it many times to fully get my head around it and ways to talk about it. But I'm really excited about it. And I think it's really worth, like, if anyone is fascinated with infinity, getting a bit closer to why it's multiple infinity or infinite different infinities. And the good thing is that this is the last proof. If you have this, then here you go, infinite infinity.
You've hit transcendence. You're good. There's your nirvana.
Exactly.
Like you said earlier, you know, you can do this with the power set of a power set and then the power set of a power set of a power set. And it is sort of inception, right? So it's infinite and there are infinite infinities of these increasing sizes. So, you know, as we start to think about what this looks like and the grander scale of things. I mean, again, it's like what you said at some point, maybe last episode, where it was like, at some point, we're going to hit the largest number we can think of, which still makes me mad. I'm going to be mad about that all day now. But thinking about this infinite infinities of increasing sizes, at some point, all of us are going to have like an upper bound of an infinity.
That will definitely happen. Although we have discussed the proof of infinite infinity, so we're in an advantageous position, I would say.
Yeah, and I think, you know, we talked about the countable infinities. There are also other types of infinities, like if they're countable, are they uncountable? And the answer is yes. If you think about things like we talked about the ocean, you know, droplets of water in the ocean, you know, how do you quantify moments? There are things like that. I was thinking about with calculus, where we have the limit goes to infinity and like what actually is a derivative. It's this infinitesimally, that is not how you say that word, but whatever. I'm not going to mess it up any more than I just did, but you know, you get smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller. So it's not just infinitely large. There can also be infinitely small, which is really cool. The other thing that I was thinking about just as we were talking about this was I nerd out about D&D all the time, but there's like this book of infinite spells, the Infinity Gauntlet, like all these places where we see it and infinity stones and what that means. And how that sort of affects whatever it is you're doing. It's so cool. And I think that one of the things that Cantor perceived with infinity, he perceived the essence of mathematics to be freedom. And we talked at the top of one of the earlier episodes about limiting, like, why would you limit yourself? Like, of course, Cantor was destined to determine infinity if he is perceiving the essence of math to be freedom, because what is more freeing than infinity?
Absolutely. And it's really interesting to see how people entering this kind of way of thinking can alter how we think about maths in general, in a way, and several other aspects of our lives as well.
The thing that you just said now caused me to think about Alan Turing. And, you know, he obviously did the Enigma machine, very influential in World War II. And I watched The Imitation Game when it came out, whatever that was, 2014 or something. And one of the things that struck me in that movie was that mathematicians, and I've talked about this in a few places, so I may have already said this here, but he came into Bletchley Park, the movie would, and I know it's not 100% accurate, but for purposes of this story, he came into Bletchley Park and everybody else was at the time, all the other people were trying to crack the Enigma code daily with their human brains. And he envisioned something that didn't exist ever, a machine that could do that. And they cast the guy who played Tyrion Lannister as his boss, but he tried to present this idea to him. He tried to present this idea to his team, and none of them wanted to hear it because they were like, stop wasting your time on this thing that doesn't exist and start putting your efforts, because you're supposed to be smart, towards breaking the code. And I had a conversation with my friend, and I said, you know, at the time I was teaching and I was thinking about this, and I was like, gosh, I said, it's a shame that we're losing people that will think like this. You know, like, math isn't this cool, amazing, wonderful thing. Like, people are like, oh, math, I gotta, you know, I gotta study it or whatever. Like, they aren't that excited about it. But like, it is so creative. It is so wonderful. It's so freeing. It's infinite. There's always more out there. And what she told me at the time was, you know, you're worried about that. I'm worried about the fact that we're losing people who will encourage that sort of thought and who will listen to that sort of thought. And I think that's been sort of permeating throughout this, because look, here's Cantor. His work was ridiculed. And maybe the lesson here is, throughout time, you just have to do what you think is right and hope that what you put out in the world is going to be the thing that sticks. But I thought that was really, really an interesting thing.
Yeah, no, I think I agree with you. In the end of the day, you have to go with your values and try the best that you can and see if what you're doing agrees with your general perspective to life. And yeah, at least if you do that, theoretically, it's less likely that something bad will come out of it.
I think perceiving the essence of math to be freedom is a great thing that he did. And there's a quote also that I really like from him that I think is a good way to close out this trilogy in this episode, which is, you know, there's the unshakable foundation of math, which we talked about. And what he said is, Cantor, my theory stands as firm as a rock. Every arrow directed against it will return quickly to its archer. How do I know this? Because I have studied it from all sides for many years, because I have examined all objections which have ever been made against the infinite numbers, and above all, because I have followed its roots, so to speak, to the first infallible cause of all created things. And we go back to the fact that exactly what you said, he did not adhere to this deterministic philosophy. He was going to do it even to his death. Like, this was the literal hill that he was going to die on. And he did. And like, also good for him.
Yes. An inspiration, I suppose, someone to look up to and think, sometimes things don't go your way, but if you believe in what you're doing and you're causing no harm.
How will infinity cause harm? And then like, watch again, in the year 3024, someone's going to be like, infinity broke the world.
If there's a 1,000 years gap, it's okay.
Well, thank you, Ioana. It's been amazing, as always, to talk to you about these mathematicians and to just get your perspective on stuff. I love our conversations always.
Thank you so much, Natalie, for having me. It's really good fun being your guest, and thank you. I'm really enjoying this time.
Thanks for joining us for today's episode of Infinitely Irrational. Can't get enough of the math and the fun? Visit us on the web at infinitelyirrational.com for the math and research behind the stories. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter, or email at podcast@infinitelyirrational.com. If you love this episode, subscribe, follow, and share. See you soon for the next one.